Aaron Hart is a Minnesota theater critic and former administrator at the Minnesota State Arts Board. Her debut novel, Haunted Ground, was nominated for the Agatha and Anthony Awards and won the Friends of American Writers Award in 2004. Her second, Lake of Sorrow, was shortlisted for a Minnesota Book Award, and the latest is out that features the main character, Nora Gavin. It's called False Mermaid. Library Journal called it rich with atmosphere and Irish legend. This exceptionally crafted story of murder, family secrets, and redemption is a welcome addition to Hart's suspenseful series. Aaron Hart, along with Patty O'Brien, will be doing a tour of the Kitchigami Libraries across the KXC listening area. And Aaron Hart is joining me now on Real Good Words. Aaron, thanks for being here.
I'm so pleased to be here with you, Heidi.
So let's just start with an introduction to this fascinating woman, Nora Gavin. I was so glad to read her story again.
She is kind of based on someone that I met while I was doing research for these books. The story of two farmers cutting turf in a bog who come across the severed head of a red-haired girl was a real story that was told to me by a brother-in-law of a friend of mine. And he introduced me then, he's an archaeologist, and he introduced me to all of his different colleagues who work in the field of archaeology and especially wetlands archaeology. And one of the people that he worked with was a woman called Maura Delaney, who was a teacher of anatomy at Trinity College, a medical doctor, and she was also very interested in archaeology and in bog people. And so Nora grew sort of as a character from my conversation with her. They had the same background, the same job, that sort of thing. I had to come up with characters who would naturally be present at the discovery of some person in the bog, and so an archaeologist and a pathologist seemed like natural characters to come out of that. And so Nora has the right job for my stories, but she also has a kind of a backstory, and that's, I talked about that a bit in the first two books, Haunted Ground and Lake of Sorrows. And she was born in Ireland, but grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. And the thing that's been hanging over her while she's in Ireland is that her sister was murdered in St. Paul 5 years previously. And so that's the story that I tackle in False Mermaid. It's kind of the backstory comes to the fore.
It's hard to even know where to begin with this. There's so many different interesting storylines. I wonder first, you know, you mentioned bogs, because I know when I read Lake of Sorrows, and I read about it first before I read it, I thought, well, I don't know that I would be interested in sort of bodies that are found in bogs and that, you know, how interesting it
right.
is. That. But I ended up being fascinated by it. And again, this kind of comes to the forefront in some bodies that are found near the Mississippi River in this book. But can you talk
right.
a little bit about that, about maybe your research, what interests you in this, in bogs?
The first exposure I ever had to, you know, artifacts and people found in bogs was reading the poetry of Seamus Heaney, the Nobel Prize-winning poet from Ireland. And he really uses the bog as a metaphor for memory about how things are preserved and stored there. And the interesting thing about bogs is that they're an anaerobic environment. No bacteria or mold will grow in a bog because it's cold and it's wet and it's acidic. And so organic materials that would decay in the outside world are preserved under the surface of a bog. And so it's a really interesting metaphor about how we keep things and we store things within us, you know, deep down inside that are not exposed to the air. And I like that sort of metaphor. And I like the whole metaphor of archaeology as a novelist because it lets me dig down through these layers of meaning as I'm working my way through a story, you know, psychological meaning and poetic meaning and mythological meanings of different things and symbols. And so I've really just enjoyed working with that, and I think it's just sort of an endless supply of material for a novelist. So.
Well, I know one of the things you'll be talking about when you tour the Kitchigami library system is how you do the research, what your tools are as a writer.
Right.
Do you have a background in archaeology, or how does this work for you?
I have no background in archaeology at all. My background is, of course, in theater, and I probably could have been a double major in theater and English. I took a lot of English courses as well. So I'm digging metaphorically rather than literally, but I'm really fascinated by archaeology, and I was you know, fortunate enough to have all of these contacts and people who would take me with them out on excavations so that I could see and observe the work that they do and ask them all kinds of questions about the work that they do. But I'm using it more of in a metaphorical sense than in a literal sense, although there's a lot of forensic detail and things like that in my stories. And I got that all from the people that I interview, experts in the field, and they're just fascinating. I mean, they can't stop talking about what they do because it's all so interesting, and it is really cutting edge, all the things they're able to find out now, forensic evidence from the people that they discover in the bogs. Many of them are about 2,000 years old, and many of them are probably human sacrifices from the days of the Celtic religion, pagan sacrifices.
You get a sense for your passion for research when you read this book, because it could just be sort of facts and scientific information, but you can tell even in the tone of your voice that it interests you. And you mentioned that people like to talk about it. What does it feel like to you when you're there with someone and you're finding this information and it's kind of weaving its way into your mind as a possible story you might write?
That's it exactly. I mean, I find connections in things, and sometimes they're completely unexpected, but they're things that will work so well into my story that I think, oh, I have to use this, you know? When I was doing research for Lake of Sorrows, for example, I was thinking, you know, it's about a 2,000-year-old man found in a bog, and I was thinking, well, where can I get more real-life details about a 2,000-year-old man in a bog? Maybe one of my archaeology contacts would know something, or, you know, I was you know, scheming about how could I get this real-life information. And a friend sent me an email message saying, guess what? They just found a 2,000-year-old man in the bog in Ireland. And it's in County Offaly, which is the county my husband is from. And I thought, what are the chances of that? That's just amazing, you know? And so I read him the newspaper article that mentioned the fellow who found the body was a guy called Kevin Barry. And, of course, I'm expecting my husband to say, well, that's great. You can use that in the book. Instead, he says, did you say Kevin Barry was the fellow who found the body? And I said, yes. And he said, I think that fellow's my cousin.
Oh, my.
And so there are all these strange and weird connections between people, between, you know, things, different meanings and symbols. There are all kinds of connections between the past and the present that are just too eerie for me to pass up. I mean, they're like tailor-made for a mystery writer. And so I accept them very happily and say thank you and include all of that in my story. So the upshot of that story was we went out to the place where the 2,000-year-old man had been discovered 2 weeks earlier and talked to Kevin, Patty's cousin, and he told us all kinds of fascinating details about this 2,000-year-old man, how he was wearing a leather armband around his upper arm, how he had been kind of staked down in the bog, which is one of the signs of a sacrifice, how it was just his torso and no head and no lower extremities, and how the interesting detail about the first thing that he saw was this man's thumb sticking up out of the peat. And he said, you know that half moon you have at the base of your nail, that sort of pale half moon at the base of the nail, that was just as clear as day. And the man had been in the bog for 2,300 years, they finally discovered.
Wow. We're talking with Erin Hart. Her latest novel is called False Mermaid. Speaking of connections, that title and this idea of mermaids throughout it is quite the connection. I wonder if you can kind of explain how the title weaves into many of the storylines.
Sure. I wanted this story to be about sort of shifting identity. Nora's sister was an actress, and so she would change her identity by putting on different clothes and different voices, things like that. But each of the characters in this story goes through a kind of transformation. And I've always been fascinated by the idea of mermaids, things, creatures who are sort of half one thing and half another, and neither is really decisive. And there are all kinds of stories in Ireland as well about selkies, which are sort of variation on the mermaid theme. And a selkie is a seal that can shed its skin and become a human for a time. But once it discovers its skin again, which usually has been hidden away by someone, sort of part of the enchantment, the selkie has to return to the sea. And I've been fascinated by the stories like that that are collected in Ireland and Scotland and up into Scandinavia. And I thought, well, that story can be a part of this as well. I can use that as a kind of symbol for the transformation that Nora's sister goes through, how Nora really realizes that she didn't really know her sister very well, and what sort of a person was she, and was she half one thing and half another, or, you know, was she cut from whole cloth? And then I found, as I was doing research for the story, I had to do a lot of research about the plants that grow along the Mississippi River in Minnesota, because that's where a lot of the story takes place. Nora believes that her sister was murdered in Hidden Falls Park, which is at the along the gorge in the Mississippi between Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I discovered that there's a plant that grows at river bottoms in black ash swamps, like exist at the bottom of the river there, called False Mermaid. And I thought, well, that's going to go in my story for sure. It actually doesn't grow or hasn't been discovered in that exact spot, but it does grow along the St. Croix and down at Whitewater State Park in St. Paul. So I was in touch with the botanist from the DNR, and they gave me a dispensation to put it at Hidden Falls Park anyway. So. But all of these little things, these little connections come up because of the, you know, I always say to people I waste a lot of time doing research, but it's through the research that I find these little connections and significances that then make their way into the story.
As I read this book, the parts that take place near Hidden Falls, I had an apartment near there. I spent a lot of time, you know, kind of on the trails. And mm-hmm. you captured so perfectly kind of the mix of that area, but being beautiful, but kind of scary, like, you know, things have happened there.
Right.
There's just
kind of wild and dangerous and
yeah.
very far removed, it seems, from the top of the bluff, which is only 100 feet away. You know?
Right, right. Tell us a little more about that place and how you wanted it to be shown in this book.
If you go down and wander around at Hidden Falls, you see all of these areas that are sort of dead spots and sort of hummocks of earth that have been moved. That is a place that floods every spring. And so water makes its way into the woods and kind of pushes around these piles of dirt and debris. And so you can imagine that people are buried there, you know. And that was the first thing that struck me when I went down there. And it's also just a tangle of vines and wild plants and nettles and different things that, you know, you don't want to get mixed up in if you can possibly help it. So it had a sort of psychological significance for Nora Gavin. It's a place where, you know, people get up to things that they wouldn't get up on the surface. So to me, it was sort of a stand-in for the other world as exists in Ireland, you know, the place where you can sort of put your hand through a veil and be in an entirely different universe almost. In Ireland, they talk about the little people and all of their mischief, but Hidden Falls to me was kind of a stand-in for that place here in America. And so it was important to have kind of parallels. I'm never satisfied with one mystery. I have to have two mysteries going. And connections kind of between the two
mm-hmm.
always. So that was one of the connections, was that Hidden Falls stood in as the other world in St. Paul.
This may be a strange question, but, you know, this story takes place in St. Paul, but also in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And we go back and forth between those things. Is that how you're writing it? Are you writing these stories sort of separately and then putting them together?
I knew that I had to keep sort of hopping across the pond because
mm-hmm.
I didn't want to lose track of what was happening with Cormac McGuire, who's Nora's boyfriend and archaeologist. And his story is that he's in Ireland visiting his father, who he has heard is ill. And he's sort of conflicted about that. His father left his family when he was a child, and so his mother is long dead, and he's had no connection with the father until his father moved back to Ireland from Chile a couple of years previously. So he's really, you know, he'd really much rather be with Nora and helping her with her case over in St. Paul, but he feels sort of obligated to see what's happening with his father as well. And then he gets kind of caught there by some other health troubles that his father has. And so, you know, one of the themes of the book is that it's about a person who's divided. Mermaid is half one thing and half another. But in this case, the each of the characters is divided in some way. So Cormac is divided. Should he be in Ireland? Should he be in America with Nora? He's conflicted about, you know, what his responsibilities, what his obligations are. And as I was writing it, it was, you know, I would tell a bit of Nora's story, and then I would tell a bit of Cormac's story. And I wanted to find that connection, as I said, between the two mysteries. And so Cormac gets caught up in the story of a woman who supposedly was a Selkie, who disappeared in 1895. And he helps a folklorist friend kind of dig up stories about her and people's memories of this woman who people just assumed returned to the sea and left her husband and two children. And they begin to believe that the woman was murdered by her husband, which would be a parallel to the story of Nora's sister, and that's what Nora has always believed, is that her brother-in-law is guilty of the crime, but she's never been able to prove anything against him. And so that's where the parallels start to connect in those two stories.
One thing I really liked was how it seemed like, you know, Nora does come back to, she really wants to find what about what happened to her sister, and it seems like she's had enough time to be able to come back and look at this case with a fresh pair of eyes, because she was kind of stopped before she left. Right. But she's also not, she's not objective on this case, of course. And she's also listening to some of the things that she's hearing sort of inside herself. There's some of the characters that are feeling that too. Like early on when she goes to a coffee shop, she really has no proof that her sister had been there, but she gets sort of this vision. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How about how she kind of has to trust some of those things that aren't explainable almost.
Right, right. She's a scientist, you know, she's a medical doctor and an anatomy teacher, but she has all of these sort of intuitions that can't be ignored. They're really extremely strong, and she's had these since the series began. I think there was a connection. She felt a strong connection to the red-haired girl in the first story who reminded her so much of her sister, and got really caught up in that case because she had this connection to this woman with red hair who was just like her sister. So in False Mermaid, she goes to a place in Lower Town, which is a place, the neighborhood I used to work in. I used to work at the Say Arts Board, and they had an office down there. And so there are all of these old warehouse buildings, and some of them are artist studios and creative kinds of places. And she's walking along the street and sees in a storefront window these video projections and photo projections, and she sees an image of her sister and realizes eventually, you know, that it could have been shot, you know, a few years ago. But she doesn't really know much about, you know, what her sister would have been doing down there. She kind of follows her nose and finds this coffee shop and just shows the photo of her sister to the woman who runs the coffee shop and finds out that, yeah, her sister was a regular there and used to work upstairs doing voice work like a lot of actors do. They record audiobooks and they do advertising and things like that. And so there was a studio upstairs where her sister used to work, and it's something that's completely brand new. She had no idea that this was going on. Her sister never mentioned anything about it. And through those sorts of connections, she begins to find other things as well. She goes to the public library in downtown St. Paul and knows that her sister was there the day she disappeared, but has no idea what she was doing there. And at one point, she goes to the place in the stacks where she and her sister used to hang out when they were children. They would go there every summer, hot summer day, you know. And she finds a book that's turned backwards in the stacks, just like Trina, her sister, used to leave when they were children, so she could find her book the next day. They wouldn't check it out. They would just come back and read more. And she turns, or, you know, takes the book out and finds a color plate and a verse from an old song that mentions the false mermaid. And she gets a sort of shiver, so she can't really explain these things to people. And maybe they're real and maybe they're not, you know, and they can't be trusted. She goes back and can't find the book again. And its title is not in the catalog for the library. So they're kind of otherworldly. They're kind of eerie things. But they also can't be denied. And they're the things that kind of put her on the path to discovering what really happened to her sister.
Erin, we've heard a little bit about, you know, your how you research to write your novels. What about the creative side of it? Trusting your own intuition. Is there a place you go where, you know, you feel more open to write, or a time, or what's it like for you?
I always say that the best ideas come to me sort of in dreams, in that half-conscious state between sleep and wakefulness. So either drifting off to sleep or just waking up in the morning, especially waking up in the morning, I get ideas about, you know, what I want to work on that day, or, you know, some connection that I hadn't thought of before. But I also really have to go to Ireland. You know, I have to go and spend time there. My husband always says, oh, more research. How long do we have to be here? And I say, you know, I don't know. I just have to walk around for a while and see what comes to me. Because the place really inspires me. It is so otherworldly. And I get so many ideas just walking around and being in the landscape that it's something that I really, really have to do. For False Mermaid, I went up to Donegal and tried to find a really deserted spot and found this wonderful abandoned fishing village called Port, that's just north of Glencolum Kill in southwest Donegal. And just being there and standing in the mist and hearing the waves beat against the rocky beach, and, you know, imagining the seals out in the bay there, they have seal breeding caves all around that area, was just a total inspiration for writing that part of the story. And the connection that Cormac and Nora both feel to the place and to the landscape and to the animal life that's there, and all of that is really important in bringing the mythology sort of into the present day as well. I really ought to have some sort of ritual. You know, I get easily distracted, you know, doing other things and away from the story. So I always say I don't really go to a special place except inside my head. You know, I have to close my eyes and put myself in the place with the people and you know, physically turn myself around and say, okay, what's here, and what's the air feel like on my skin, and where's the sun, or is there sun, or is it raining, or, you know, really put myself physically in the place where the characters are to really sort of burn ahead and write some of those scenes. I always say too, I'm not really a writer of chapters. I write in scenes. Maybe it's my theatrical training, but I always have to sort of see the little movie playing in my head in order to be able to write it down. And I also make my husband act things out with me. You know, if I'm doing it, especially a big fight scene or something, I have to make him grapple with me so that I can see, you know, now, how would this person be standing, and how would she be getting pushed over the edge, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, he's willing, but if anybody saw us, it'd be pretty funny.
Speaking of your husband, Paddy O'Brien, now he's a musician, an Irish musician. You guys are starting this tour of the Kitchigami Library System. It starts this week, February 24th, at the Brainerd Library. Tell us what that's going to be like, how he's involved. Tell us a little bit about him.
Sure. He is a wonderful musician. He grew up in a thatched house in Ireland. He was born in the 1940s. And so, you know, to me, it's like he's from another century because of the way that he grew up in rural Ireland. But he's a musician and has been since he was a child, just really got pulled into the music as a small kid and couldn't really do anything else. He plays the button accordion, and the music that he plays is the old traditional music, the dance music, jigs and reels and hornpipes and things like that. He doesn't sing. I do the singing. But when we do a program together at a library, for example, I will talk a little bit about the previous books, a little bit about them, and then I'll be talking mostly about False Mermaid on this tour. And I show images of the places that inspired the story, and read a little bit from the book, a couple of different little sections, and Patty plays music and talks a little bit about the traditional music, and the tunes that he picks kind of reinforce and back up the readings that I do. And on this tour, we're actually doing something special for Kitchigami Libraries, is that we're also doing writing, and Patty's doing a talk about the music as well, in addition to our regular book chat. And he's also playing a little bit, kind of a mini concert in a lot of the different locations as well. So he'll talk about kind of the history of the music and the different instruments played in Irish traditional music. And I'll do a workshop about writing about setting and location and what makes that so important in writing mysteries and other kinds of fiction as well, and how to get really authentic details of a setting. What are the tools in your sight kit is the title of my workshop. So that's something special that we'll be doing just for this tour in the Kichigami Library System. We're excited about that.
Sounds great. That starts this Thursday, February 24th, 5 o'clock at the Brainerd Public Library. Continues on through Saturday, March 5th, and you'll be stopping in Cass Lake, Bemidji, Pine River, Longville, Black Duck, Walker, Park Rapids, and Wadena. If you need information on Aaron Hart and Patty O'Brien at the Kichigami Libraries, you can call KAXE 218-326-1234. Aaron has lots of information on her books and the tour and at aaronhart.com, the website. Now, Aaron, you also sent me a CD of music, and I wonder if you'd choose something for us to listen to at the end of our conversation here.
Well, any of the instrumental pieces would be great, but there's also, I wanted to mention, there's a song on that recording called The Generous Lover, and it's a song that Nora Gavin sings in Haunted Ground, my first novel, and so I thought people might be interested in hearing what that sounds like off the page. So if you wanted to choose that cut, I'd be happy about that.
That'd be great. Erin, thank you so much. It was great talking with you. I really enjoyed the book.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you
so much, Heidi.
The first time I saw my love, happy was I. I knew not what love was, nor how to deny. But I made too much freedom of my love's company. Sang my generous lover, you're welcome to me. Oh, my friends and relations, they angry are all, because I had gone with you from my father's fine hall. But my friends and relations, let them all angry be, for my generous lover, you're welcome to me. Now it's fare thee well, darling, I now must away, for I in this country no longer can stay. But keep your mind easy and keep your heart free. Let no man be your sharer, my darling, but me. Oh, this poor pretty creature, she stood on the ground, with her cheeks white as ivory, and the tears running down, crying, "Jimmy, dearest Jimmy, you're the first that e'er wooed me. And I'm sorry that I ever said you're welcome to me. Oh, happy is the girl that ne'er loved a man, and easy can tie up a narrow waistband. She is free from all sorrow and sad misery, that never said my lover, you're welcome to me.